Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend's edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. On this weekend show, we're going to be discussing some of the, I guess, change in trends and some of the economic data that we have seen throughout this fourth quarter, compare that to what we saw throughout this year, and then all the projections next year for what the Fed is going to do and how markets have reacted on the back of those expectations. We are chatting with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer over at Bleakley Financial Group. Now, Peter, high level, look, we have seen generally weaker economic data in the fourth quarter of this year. Q3 came out with around a 5% GDP number. A lot of people are saying, look, that's definitely the top of almost a blow-off anomaly data point here. But look, the Fed and a lot of investors, I think, are cheering some of this weaker economic data, still a slow downtick in inflation as they carry that over to Fed expectations and now pricing in rate cuts starting in March of next year and three more for the rest of next year. Peter, how are you viewing this weakening in U.S. economic data?
So let's take it piece by piece. So as you say, we had a great third quarter. But even but slicing that up, a lot of it had to do with inventory build and government spending and basically higher end spending, whereas the lower end consumer, and all you had to do was listen to any retail conference call for the past month, they're more challenged. And if you look at the fourth quarter estimate so far for GDP, it's probably going to be around 1% at best. I wouldn't be surprised after we digest December data and November data in the coming months that it could be a minus sign. So with the consumer, as I said, it's very bifurcated. Listening to Walmart, Target, Kroger, Home Depot, Lowe's, Ross Stores, Burlington Northern, TJ Maxx, Dollar Tree, just to throw out a bunch of names, Foot Locker. And, you know, there's some consistent themes here. The consumer is very discerning, and I've heard the word choiceful in terms of how they're spending their money. You have more people that are making six figures that are shopping at Kroger supermarkets and Walmart, as we've heard a few quarters now, them saying that. And then you have the manufacturing sector, which is basically in a recession and has been for more than a year, but it's been that way throughout the world. It's a global manufacturing recession and global trade also being somewhat subdued. So it's a very kind of upside down economy with these different cross currents. And then you look at housing, which is another chunk of the house of the economy, and that's also upside down, where you have the pace of transactions with existing homes being near multi-decade lows. But on the other hand, the builder business in sort of filling that inventory gap seems to be doing better. Toll Brothers, as on the day we have this, reported a good quarter, and the stock's trading up. So sort of a strange economy, but I still think that the impact of much higher interest rates relative to what we were used to for 15 years still has time to flow through, still has time to negatively impact those that have coming debt due the rest of this year into next year and the year after. So the knock on to the economy, I think, continues. And one last big piece of this puzzle when we look at the economy is the labor market, and we're seeing multiple signs of moderation. We saw that in the EDP report, where the three-month average is about 100,000, which is quite a downtick from what we've been seeing in the Conference Board consumer confidence number. Those that say jobs are hard to get is at a multi-year high. We have continuing claims that are a multi-year high. So now we're seeing the slowdown in hirings, not really a pickup in firings as measured by low jobless claims, but certainly a pickup in hirings, which is typically the first reaction on the part of an employer and how to deal with a slowing economic backdrop. If this continues, then you'll see the pickup in firings, but just not yet. So I know when I went on there, but hopefully that answered the question, at least on the state of the U.S. economy. And then Europe is basically in a recession. Germany, the biggest economy in that region, certainly is Asia's mixed, with China obviously seeing continued slowdown, but other parts of some strength in Singapore, Southeast Asia, generally speaking, and Japan. So very much a mixed bag.
Well, Peter, just to that theme of it being a mixed bag, a lot of these different segments of the economy that you broke down there, there's bifurcation even within their data, and there seems to be a tug of war between bulls and bears as to which directions things are trending. So when you bring up the consumer, you know, you brought up them being choiceful and discerning, and that certain companies are getting a bid, but where other companies may be pointing out a totally different forecast from their Q3 earnings reports. And as they look into Q4 in the beginning of next year, manufacturing, it's been weak for a while, but there's other segments that are saying, hey, manufacturing, it's got an uptick in certain cities. And so people are looking at different data. The same thing with the jobs report. You can look at certain cracks under the surface, but overall, people still feel like the jobs market has been stronger than one would expect, considering the macro backdrop of the tightening cycle and a lot of companies having to jostle with inflation. What do you think is going to be the thing that gets the market's moving in a more, I guess, cohesive narrative where either we're in a recession going into next year or we're having this proverbial soft landing? Because it seems like there's not agreement even amongst economists or in the financial media on these topics.
Well, we still have sort of a post-COVID world flow through that has distorted a lot of these data points. Who would have thought that mortgage rates would more than double and home prices would still go higher? And that's because, you know, the Federal Reserve's policies turn that upside down. You mentioned the labor market hanging in there. It certainly is. But I think a key reason why we're seeing a very modest pace of firings is that companies spent the last couple of years sort of rebuilding their staff, particularly if you were in leisure and hospitality and or owning a restaurant, for example, where your business got crushed when with the shutdowns. You lost a lot of people. It's taken a lot of time to get those people back. But now I think a lot of that sort of demand in that sector particularly has been satiated. If you look at the ADP report, you actually saw a decline for the first time in a long time in the number of jobs within leisure and hospitality. But if I spent the last 2 years struggling to build up staff, you know, I'll eat some profit margin just to maintain it rather than just quickly firing them. But I think this is sort of a slow moving story, but a story that will continue to pick up steam. And I think it's very important from an investor standpoint is to focus on the trajectory of things, because not every economic expansion happens all at once. Not every downturn happens all at once. It happens in different type of stages. You know, we talk about the big sharp rise in interest rates. Well, that doesn't affect everybody all at once. It only affects you if you're either needing to borrow to buy a home or a new project for business, or you have a loan coming due. If you don't have either, well, then at least right now, you're not necessarily impacted directly. I say directly because indirectly you are in some way because it slows growth, but you're not directly impacted by the rise in interest rates. But if you have a loan coming due in 2025, at some point you're going to get impacted. And chances are your borrowing rate then will probably be higher than on the loan that's going to mature. So it's eventually going to get around to you. And that's what makes all this somewhat unusual when you have 15 years of zero interest rates and then you skyrocket up all in 1 year. It has, there aren't really any historical playbooks for that kind of environment. This is just very different in terms of that sort of move in interest rates, really all out of nowhere over an 18-month period relative to the zero bound that we had for 15 years, were obviously negative in Japan and Europe.
Let's focus a little bit more on interest rates then, because they are also a barometer for what people are expecting the Fed to do. And look, the 10-year was pretty much at 5% at the start of November and has moved almost straight down since then into the low 4% range. That ties in with everybody expecting the Fed to start cutting. Where is the sweet spot for, let's say, interest rates? Because boy, oh boy, it has been volatile.
Well, sweet spot, I guess it's tough to say. I mean, I think if you look at short-term interest rates, the Fed's done raising interest rates. The Bank of Canada sat on its hands. The Reserve Bank of Australia sat on its hands. The ECB, the BOE. I mean, these central banks are done raising interest rates. So you can argue pretty easily that short-term interest rates have stopped going up. And they're pretty attractive here at these levels. I think the real question is what happens with longer-term interest rates. And if you look at the U.S. 10-year, as we're speaking here, we're already down to 4.11, astonishingly. But it was 3.75, give or take, in June, July. And then the Bank of Japan decided to widen yield curve control, and then we just took off all the way to 5%. And it was not just a rise in U.S. yields, it was a global rise in interest rates. And as you mentioned, we've since backed off here, but we're still above where we were over the summer. I think that this is more of a needed consolidation of that yield move higher before another leg higher in yields. But it definitely is happening in conjunction with the moderation in inflation stats everywhere in Europe and Asia and also in the U.S., which is then also triggering the belief that the Fed, forget about raising interest rates again, the market's obviously pricing in now a bunch of rate cuts next year. And that has led to this rally here. But, you know, we're rallying also, people have to understand, because of these worries about growth. And I understand the excitement that maybe the Fed will get out of your face with the rate hikes, but they're getting out of your face for not necessarily good reason. At the same time, just because they're getting out of your face on the rate side doesn't mean they're really out of your face, because they're still going to keep rates elevated even if they cut. Certainly, we're not going back to zero anytime soon. And central banks are still shrinking their balance sheet. So the Bank of Canada sat on their hands, but they said, we're going to continue to shrink our balance sheet. The Fed has plans to continue to shrink their balance sheet. In the Financial Times within the last week, I saw an article that the ECB is thinking about speeding up the pace at which they shrink their balance sheet, or at least they cut back on the amount of reinvestments out of their pandemic purchase program. I mean, we're well past the pandemic, and the ECB still has a pandemic emergency purchase program. There is still a level of tightening that is going to continue on, even if central banks, in a way, cut rates.
Yeah, it's a really strange environment to be in, because we still do have some emergency measures in place that you would think would have already wrapped up by now, especially if the economy is supposed to be on somewhat better footing, according to some metrics. But this fall in rates has been a boon to gold. Let's talk about gold, Peter, because it's had a lot of factors, and I'd like to get your thoughts on which ones matter. Obviously, geopolitics and some of the conflict in the Middle East did play a factor, but falling rates and the falling dollar also are a tailwind for the precious metal. People have been buying bonds, which has brought down the rates, but the question is, why are people buying gold? Why are people buying bonds? It's undeniable that gold's had a breakout here. We had the highest monthly close last Thursday, highest weekly close last Friday. So there's some good technical picture, but what is moving gold at this point, and what is its trajectory moving forward?
So the biggest buyer of gold over the last couple of years, that really began in the second quarter of 2022, that then accelerated into the third quarter, where you saw the highest level of central bank buying of gold going back decades. And it could be on record. I just don't have a chart going back that far. And that was triggered by the EU, the US and the EU confiscating about half of Russia's central bank reserves. The amazing thing about gold's behavior over the last couple of years is since January 2022, so call it right on the cusp of the Fed finally raising interest rates and shrinking their balance sheet, if you look at the five-year tip yield, you've seen a 400-plus basis point increase in real rates from about negative 200 to positive 200. You've seen a notable rise in the dollar relative to the euro, yen, and pound predominantly. And gold hung in phenomenally well in the face of that. And I think a lot of that had to do with the voracious buying from central banks. Now you throw in the historical tailwinds for gold, a softer dollar and lower real rates. And we've seen a back off of about 50 basis points in the five-year real rate. And that was enough. So gold became this coiled spring and busting out of that. Now, I know it's sort of, again, struggling around the $2,000 level. This last Sunday night, we saw a spike above 2,100 in a short covering, thinly traded Sunday night panic. But I think it's pretty telling, again, how well it traded over the last 2 years in the face of those headwinds. And now you throw in the tailwind, and it seems that there's a lot of further upside potential here if that the real rate move and the dollar softness continues.
What about carrying that over to the gold stocks? We saw higher volume come into some of the majors. GDX has rebounded. fairly strong after that breakdown in October and even just in the second half of November. Have you seen a discernible and significant sentiment shift towards those gold stocks that just consistently underperformed gold?
I think while we've seen a rise in some of these gold stocks, I still think that people just are apathetic towards it. And that's because, number one, they've been teased before with this $2,000 level in gold. Number two, it's buying miners. You have two different types of buyers of miners. You have those that follow them closely, can differentiate one from the other. And then you have the generalist who says, okay, gold's going up, let me get some exposure, and I'll just buy Newmont, Barrick, and Agnico, the three biggest. And that'll give me my gold exposure. But even with those, you know, there's still this history of disappointment in terms of earnings growth, disappointment in terms of keeping one's cost in line, just constant disappointment. And, you know, that there's a lot of sort of scars on people's backs by owning miners over the years. I mean, even just look back from 1999 when gold bottomed at 250 and had its meteoric rise. I mean, these miners just have traded so poorly in the face of that it's just, there's just so much still disgust. So I think what you need is a sustained move higher above 2000 in the price of gold. And I emphasize the word sustained. And that's when I think these gold companies that have all in sustainable costs, call it a range of, you know, the really high quality ones, probably closer to 1000, and the other ones, maybe 1300, where there's some serious profit margin and cash flow generation that's going to happen, some serious debt pay down, that these companies can finally get rewarded. But you can be sure, as human nature never changes, that will happen if, again, the rise in gold can be sustained, because who wants to miss a momentum rise? And these miners are going to experience at some point a good, solid momentum rise, and everyone's going to chase it and no one's going to want to miss it.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how things evolve with the precious metals mining stocks. And if they do get that momentum rise, I think a lot of people listening will be happy to see that, Peter. But another market we absolutely want to get your thoughts on is the energy space. When you look at oil and to a lesser extent, nat gas, they've been very volatile. But oil really broke out and got above 90 just for a little while. Some of that may, again, have been on the back of geopolitical concerns, but there's a lot of other things going on in the oil market with OPEC and with the cuts in production that were supposed to be there but didn't appear. Well, now oil has dove all the way back down to 70. So what do you make of the oil patch and the related oil stocks?
Well, there's definitely worries about the demand side. There's no doubt with concerns with global growth. And an OPEC meeting that was clearly, trying to think of the right word, clearly not really firmly across the board of its members dedicated to keeping inventories at bay. You know, Saudi Arabia is trying to corral the group, but I think there was a lack of clarity in the messaging. And I think that's why we've seen the sell-off. The interesting thing about the sell-off to around 70 is that it's happening when the DOE, Department of Energy, reported their weekly crude oil inventory number that showed a much sharper than expected decline in inventories. So I'm still a bull on energy. I do think that the supply side is going to sort of right size itself relative to the demand side. And when you look out over, you know, a multi-year time frame outside of the current cyclical concerns, emerging markets are still going to be the big demand story for crude oil. And that's going to lead to much higher prices in the coming years. But it is interesting to see this. And, you know, one has to wonder the state of the global economy with oil trading at $70.
Well, that is the big question, right? Carry that over to the global economy and that weakness that we have seen in oil. Peter, we don't usually talk about cryptocurrencies either, but I do want to bring up Bitcoin simply because Bitcoin has been on quite the run here. It had more or less flatlined through September and October, under $30,000, more around $26,000, $27,000. And then mid to late October popped up to about 34,000 and currently is around 44,000. It's been a strong mover. Any insights on what's going on in the crypto space?
Well, certainly what lit a fire was the growing likelihood of ETF approval to own actual Bitcoin as opposed to owning the futures on Bitcoin. So that definitely was a huge demand driver. And then you throw in just the risk on picture we saw in markets in November because of, slowing inflation. And again, the Fed has done raising interest rates trade. So it's rallied along with everything else. The question now is it going to act like gold in a way and sort of be this complement in terms of stores of value that people are looking for? Or is it just trading with the NASDAQ, which you can argue is what it has done for the last 15 years, is overlay a chart of the NASDAQ 100 and Bitcoin, and they pretty much have mimicked each other. I think that those that are bullish on gold have soulmates and those that are bullish on Bitcoin in the sense of, it was created to have something finite that can't be printed by central banks and can be the store of value, because that's all it's now going to be, a store of value. It's not a medium exchange, because every time you got to transact in it, you got to pay taxes. Can it be the store of value that a lot of the adherents want it to be? And maybe so. I'm not going to say that it's not, but I still think that you can't really tell in a 14-year life cycle whether it's going to be the case. And again, it could, but gold at least has 5,000 years of a track record rather than 14 years. So I still think it remains to be seen what Bitcoin wants to be when it gets older, and can it really be that store of value? And we'll see. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But we have to also keep in mind that it's not really the only finite asset. A 1968 Mickey Mantle is a finite asset too. They aren't making any more of it. And yes, it goes up in value over time, but you don't hear people talking about it like they do Bitcoin.
Yeah, very good point there, Peter. Very timely too with the baseball card reference with what happened this week. So, hey, Peter, thank you very much for your time on this weekend show. It's always great chatting with you. Everyone, you can follow along with Peter on his website, his Substack, which is the Book Report. I will post a link within the weekend show to Peter's Substack, where you can keep up to date on what he's seeing in the economic data and market move. Peter, thank you again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you, guys. You too as well.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.